Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I'm Renee Coleman, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man.
Hey, hey.
Do you know that all Vietnam veterans that I've met over the years were all junkies?
Huh.
You know? It was crazy.
Yeah, it was,
they either committed suicide or they were homeless.
Yeah.
You know, that's a sad thing.
Many of them.
Being a Vietnam vet.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I met one homeless vet who, after I gave him some money, he told me that in action, he killed three people.
Huh.
He killed three, you know, enemies.
Oh, okay.
You know, at least he thought they were enemies. And when he shot them and he killed the three of them, he ejaculated.
Huh. Okay.
Kind of weird.
All right.
Anyway, I just had to get that out there.
Yeah, right up top, sure.
Yeah, I had to get that out there.
Clear the decks.
Because, I mean, we've all ejaculated over something, right?
Well, yeah, hopefully. Yeah, yeah.
Now, have you ever, I'm asking both of you, have you ever used the opposite hand to jerk off? Just for, you know, just to try it out?
The stranger?
The stranger, exactly.
Now you, Manny? I've done it many times.
The stranger.
Yeah, you gotta give your regular hand a break every once in a while, you know. So yeah, and it's actually kind of cool because it's like you're cheating, you know,
on yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of good, and it, you know, you don't use that hand much for other things, you know. It helps you out in things, you know, a tennis racket or a golf club or a baseball bat, you know. But using the opposite hand can feel pretty good sometimes.
Okay.
You know, right. And you guys have never done it.
Pro tips from men.
You've never used the opposite hand?
The stranger.
Yeah, you have?
I've met the stranger.
Okay, what about you, Renee?
I can't recall that, but, you know. Who knows?
Because, you know.
Not during the holiday season.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, people have sexual orientations and they like certain things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've had many partners and everyone likes what they like.
Sure. The heart knows what it wants.
Yeah, you know. So I remember one time, you know, being with a lover. And she wanted me to go down on her.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't go down on her because I was tied up. You know, so how is that supposed to happen for her?
She has to go up.
Yeah, she's got to go up.
Huh.
But, you know, so it's all crazy going nuts. You know, complicated world. Sex acts are, you know, everyone has their fantasies. And the older you get, you remember some of those fantasies. But you just can't do them anymore, you know.
Okay.
You know.
Because they're illegal?
No, well, some of them are in some states, I guess.
Right,
you know,
sure.
Like this state, I think everything's illegal in this state. You know, you can't sodomize your partner anymore here in this state.
Huh.
You know, I guess you can get away with it.
Yeah.
But there's cameras everywhere, and we have this new governor who's just an asshole. So, literally an asshole. And he probably likes it up the ass.
We got Troop Noel here, so they're the whole state police there.
You know, so, yeah, he's got the troopers, you know, who, you look at these guys, a lot of these macho law enforcement people, and they all look like they should be part of the village people, you know?
Okay.
You know, they got the mustaches.
Right.
Buff and stuff, you know, that kind of stuff. Anyway, I hear
what you're talking about.
You know, I asked some female people if they did the same thing, use the opposite hand to get off, and they said yeah.
Okay.
They said yeah, too. And I went around the streets of New Orleans asking this to people.
Oh, really?
Man on the street.
Yeah, it was a man on the street kind of thing. And most of everyone just looked at me and ran.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it's something to think about, Troubled Nation. Use the opposite hand once in a while.
Okay.
You'll appreciate it. The other regular hand will appreciate it, too.
All right. Very good. Well, where do we go from there?
down.
Hopefully up. Hopefully up from there. Well, I don't know. There's all kind of stuff in the news. You know, we had this the worst crash in the history of the causeway yesterday. Even made the national news.
It was a good
50-car pileup there.
Good.
They had.
How many people died?
No people died, amazingly.
And nothing in the drink.
Nobody went over the side. No, I guess they have those new high guardrails on the causeway that that's for those outside the city.
And Trump will take credit for it.
Oh, well.
He'll take credit for saving the lives.
Not even president yet, but
I'm
sure it won't stop him from taking credit. Well, speaking of the Trump administration, you know, we have this crackpot RFK Jr., Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody was pointing out today that you know, he was an intravenous heroin addict for 14 years.
RFK Jr. was?
Yeah, yeah.
But he was?
Yeah, I believe so. He was definitely a heroin addict for some extended period of time, but I'm not sure the 14 years, but they're saying yet he's concerned about the polio vaccine.
Yeah.
And I was thinking yesterday, it's like RFK wants to make polio great again.
Okay. I get it, I guess. I don't know.
Again.
Yeah. Again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it was big. It was big in the like the 40s and 50s. You know, had a good run there.
Maybe he will make black tar heroin great again.
Maybe so.
You know,
because
I just got a delivery of some black tar heroin from Mexico.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's
back
good
on the horse.
Stuff. Yeah.
All right.
It's good stuff. So, yeah, RFK Jr., well, you know, fuck that guy, man.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, his parents.
He's no Vietnam vet.
Yeah, he's no Vietnam vet.
No, no.
He's a guy who slept under that tanning light one a little thing a little too long.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, but look, do you know these service dogs, you know, these seeing eye dogs, they call them, for the blind? Have you ever seen one?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
I saw one the other day, kind of near where I work, in this neighborhood, actually. And do they actually know what their job is? I mean...
The dog?
Yeah, the dog.
Probably not.
Do they actually think they know what their job is? Because they're probably walking around, and then they see other dogs on leashes, just very jovial and stuff like that, you know. And then they look at... The service animal looks at their dog and go, my owner's a jerk. He's a doofus, man. He can't even walk straight. You know, what the fuck's wrong with this guy? You know? So
well, now they have the emotional support animals that people bring all over the place. People seem fine. They can see fine. They it's a big scam.
Yeah. Well, some people try to get a flamingo on the plane. They try to get a flamingo on the plane
because
it helps me sleep. The flamingo.
Right.
Or it helps me feel better. The flamingo.
The goats. The service goats.
Goats and
llama.
All that stuff.
Right.
It's getting out of control, that stuff. But I just thought, you know, and why don't blind people parachute? Because it scares the shit out of the dog, probably, I'm sure. You know? So,
Yeah,
I just saw
that.
I just feel bad for those seeing eye dogs. And, you know, they just think, you know, they're fucked over, man. They got a bad gig. You know, their lot in life was bad. Someone made them become a seeing eye dog, you know. All these other dogs get to roam free and, you know, do the stuff. And how does a blind person pick up the shit of a seeing eye dog? They can't see the shit.
Sense of smell?
I don't know.
Well, I believe they can smell it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but they're blind. What if they miss? You know, they're going for...
Super attuned nasal capacity.
Or maybe they get a pass, these blind people. You know, maybe they don't have to pick up after the dog.
Huh. Oh, you mean out on the street?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, was the dog shitting in the house?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't let the dog shit in the house. You have your own yard, you know. You got to clean up
your own
yard.
Well, a lot of these blind people live in apartments.
That's true.
I know. Do they have a litter box for these seeing eye dogs,
Yeah,
maybe?
I don't think you can get a dog to go in a litter box.
You know, my daughter, who's just got a cat,
keep talking.
She potty trained her cat, my daughter.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, she potty trained her cat.
Heard of people doing that.
And so she's saving money on litter.
Okay.
You know.
So she doesn't need a litter box at all?
No. The cat just goes up and flushes the toilet.
Flushes the toilet.
Yeah. Does everything. Does its own business.
Wow. That's something else.
Now, I'm not a big animal person or pet person.
Right.
You know, but I think, hey, listen, if that could save you like $20 a week on cat litter, you know.
Well, and then you don't have to. You don't have to have the open litter box, and
right,
you don't have to go clean
it.
The litter box.
You
got to
clean it.
No, if you can have a cat that
it's potty trained, you know.
Cat bidet.
Yeah, exactly. And she gives her cat a bath. The cat will take a bath
really?
In the sink.
Wow.
That is an unusual cat.
Yeah, it's an unusual cat.
Man, okay. Well, Manny, following up on something that you talked about a couple of months ago, was the movie Joker Part 2.
Oh, yeah, great movie.
So you saw that at the theater, must have?
Yeah, I saw it at the theater.
So I saw it last night. It finally came on one of the streaming services.
Oh, yeah.
And,
that movie.
Me and my family watched it. Well, you know, it was not well reviewed, and it was not well received generally,
right,
you know. But I agree with you. I thought it was really good, man.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed it.
And it was just as good as the first one with Joaquin. I thought that one was brilliant, too.
Yeah, now the first one I had a negative reaction to initially, but I think it was the mood I was in, because then I watched it a second
time. Because you didn't get any free popcorn in the theater?
No. But I did enjoy it when I on the rewatching and the one yesterday, the part two, I thought was excellent, man.
Yeah, Lady Gaga's fabulous in it.
She was good, yeah.
Yeah, they're all good in it. You
know? I like they billed it as like a musical, but it had some songs in it, but it was, you know, not
Yeah, I don't remember the music too much in it.
Yeah,
I was too enthralled by just the look of the film.
Right. And, yeah, the cinematography was cool.
And River Phoenix was fabulous in it. He was great.
Joaquin. River was the one you knew back in L.A., right?
Yeah, he was a dope fiend.
Right.
He's a good guy.
Sure.
I don't know why he's not working anymore.
Yeah. I don't know.
He's not working much anymore.
What are you pointing at me about?
Bring this up later.
You want to bring us something up now?
You remember when Alex Chilton, Untamed Youth, and the Gories played at Maxwell's?
Okay.
Alika's Attic had filmed a video that afternoon at Maxwell's, and we were all there, and that was River Phoenix's and his sister's band.
Huh. Okay.
So we were all four bands in the same.
All right, you remember a lot of things that I don't. So that's
cool.
Mind like a steel trap.
Maxwell's in New York,
in Hoboken,
across the river. Yeah.
Okay.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. Closed a couple of years ago or something.
Like probably 2008.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. That's a longer. Time's flying, man. It's hard to keep up with all this stuff.
Yes.
Well, anything else going on?
Yeah, I just found that, we had that, I think it's a big story. Luigi killed a CEO of a health company.
Right.
And, there was a manhunt for him. And, they found him within 3 or 4 days. But yet, this is crazy how things work. They find this guy in 3 or 4 days, but yet the fucking authorities can't figure out where these fucking drones in New Jersey are coming from. Yeah. You know? It's like, it's so, you can't? You can't find where this shit comes from?
Well, didn't they come out and say, well, it's just people with their personal drones and then
is that what they said?
That's their excuse. Well, we can't fit. We have no answer for it. It's just probably people.
What about
it's not well. And then also law enforcement drones and then some people are. So I guess there was a story that was out there that there was a big Iranian ship out off the coast, and they were sending these waves of drones. That was all bullshit. That was not.
Rumor.
The Iranians don't have a rowboat, man, that they could send a
drone
Navy.
From. No. And so the rumor that they were full of radiation is also false.
Yeah, no, that's bullshit.
So where are they? So there's just private citizens?
It's a hysteria. Yeah, so people are reacting. They see things in the sky.
I think
and,
that's bullshit.
People
in New Jersey.
I think it's probably in the Russians.
Okay.
Who are trying to spy on us.
Well,
you know
who knows? Certainly we do have some foreign adversaries.
What they're trying to do is sway us, lose our focus on what's really going on.
But only in New Jersey.
Yeah, and only in New Jersey. Well, no, now it's in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, all that stuff.
Okay, a lot of hysteria going on.
Yeah. Like polio.
Well, speaking of the murderer, so yes, they have this this healthcare executive gets gunned down.
Good.
And humanitarians across the country cheer.
Yeah.
And women swoon.
Yeah.
So, you know.
He's got a GoFundMe. I gave money.
You sent money? Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, in an age where.
Why do we need insurance?
45 cents.
Yeah. What do you need insurance for? Because they always fuck with you anyway. So, you know, this guy was in pain, and he was like, enough, enough. And now
he was a guy that had money. He was not being denied health care.
Yes, he was. He was being, he had severe chronic back pain, and United Health was denying him his care. They weren't covering his costs.
I don't know. I don't know the details. I'm not sure.
You know, it's just like every insurance company. You pay for insurance, right?
Right.
You know, and they probably deny you things.
Pay a fortune. I've actually never been denied anything on my, but although it cost me an arm and a leg, I actually just switched my insurance coverage. I'm now on the Obamacare for
the
first
time. Well, good. Yeah. Get an Obamacare, man. You know, because insurance for what? So you can sleep at night?
Well,
you can't sleep at night.
That's the whole insurance game. Yeah. You know, it's like you're betting that something awful will happen to you. That's the only way you can win with insurance. You know, it's like if your house burns down,
it's
then you
have to have a flood insurance. What for? Because they're not going to cover you. So I feel I'm all with Luigi, man. Kill them all, man.
Yeah. I don't think political violence is the answer here.
Well, violent revolution is the answer.
I don't think politics is the answer.
Yeah, exactly. So I gave him money, and so you know did you know that his lawyer is married to the lawyer that's representing P. Diddy? Did you know that?
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so they're going to rake up
bumper year for those guys.
Yeah. Nice dinners at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I saw, speaking of P. Diddy, you saw that Jay-Z got pulled into that whole thing along with him. It's going to be a mess, man.
And only the lawyers win.
Right.
You know. That's what it comes down.
Well,
to.
Speaking of crime and punishment, we've spoken about this guy before, the former priest Lawrence Hecker.
Yeah.
He pled guilty and he was sentenced today to life in state prison, which he's 93 years old. That may be a couple of weeks.
Yeah. So he'll be somebody's bitch.
Well,
just one life sentence?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he only has one life to live, you know, one life to give.
Good soap.
Yeah.
Is that still on that soap?
I don't think
that soap is on anymore. One Life to Live.
Yeah, I think.
I think it's only Young and the Restless.
Didn't the Days of Our
Bold
Lives.
And the Beautiful, which is my favorite.
Bold and the
one.
Beautiful. Is that
I love
on?
Bold and the Beautiful. Cow. You know, it's such a good soap opera because usually these soap operas are an hour long, but Bold and the Beautiful is only a half hour. So they get it in fast, man. They get all the drama and the conflict. They jam it in fast with their opposite. You know what I'm saying? You know, I love that. I love that fucking soap opera, man.
You get to
every day?
Catch up on your stories.
With the stranger?
Yeah. What's that?
With the stranger?
Yeah, with the stranger. Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we should. Get our guest in here, huh?
Okay, yeah. I don't know who he is, but he
all
seems
yeah,
exciting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're gonna find out together. Now, this is a guy I've known for a very long time, but he remembers more than I do. He remembers when we first met. We'll ascertain that. But he's a terrific drummer, singer, harmonica player. He's played with all kind of bands. Untamed Youth. I had with Deke Dickerson. He was the original drummer with Dash Riprock. He's played with Charlie Pickett and the MC3, the Incredible Casuals with Johnny Spampinato. He knows everybody in Rock and Roll College. He can connect a lot of dots. And without further ado, America's guest, the great Mr. F. Clark Marty. Welcome,
hello.
Clark.
Good evening.
All right.
Johnny Spampinato.
Spampinato.
Oh, Spampinato.
Yeah.
Spampinato. Gangster.
Guitar player.
Not the gangster.
Great.
As far as I know.
Joey Spampinato from NRBQ. But, well, first of all, welcome, Clark.
Thank you.
Now, Clark, I have never known you as F. Clark Marty, but I see that's how you're listed in many times in credits. Now
you don't want to ask.
What is the F for?
For fuck?
It is. Fucking.
Fucking
Clark Marty.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say maybe we should play a game where we guess what the F stands for.
Yeah. Pretty easy.
Okay. All right.
Got it. Looking at ding, ding, ding. First shot. Yeah.
Okay. All right. All
yeah,
right.
I'm looking right. at this guy. I can tell right away.
Well, so Clark, inform me, where did we first meet?
In Baton Rouge, Louisiana,
a gay
on
bar?
State Street.
Oh, okay. A gay bar in States on State Street?
No, it wasn't a gay bar.
Oh, okay.
It was on the street.
Okay.
I was coming out of a house of a young lady, and you were going into the house of a young lady, and I was like,
"Oh yeah, baby."
I was like, "Renee?" But I'd already seen you play with Alex Chilton before.
Oh, okay.
And so I was like, "Renee?" And you're like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Hey, how are you?"
"Hey, I got to go, man. I got a young lady with me." Yeah.
And he's
it's my
like,
wife.
"Oh, my girlfriend lives upstairs."
Right, right, right. Tom, my girlfriend then, my wife now.
And
was,
the ending
at,
of the story
was
is
at
he's married.
LSU at the time, yes.
That's convenient. Yeah,
you were coming
sure.
up to visit her
right,
quite a bit.
Right, yeah.
And I roped you into coming over to the band I was in, practice space.
Now
one
was that,
time,
okay,
you had your bass with you.
Sure, yeah, I'd always have the bass with me, so
and
I could practice.
We got you over there and played like maybe an hour.
Okay,
and we actually you did some of the songs that we did, and then you taught us a couple of your songs. And
okay.
somewhere I have a cassette of that.
All right,
hope to dig that up someday.
Yeah, that'd be crazy.
And it's a pretty good. It's a good tune. It's kind of jazzy, instrumental ish.
All right. Okay. Well, cool. So that must have been like.
And that was probably
1984 or something like that. 85.
More like 85.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, so at that time you were living in Baton Rouge. You were playing. Had you played with our favorite band at that time?
I was playing in our favorite band.
Okay, and our favorite band was Maury.
Don Spicer.
What's Maury's last name? Remember? He was the singer.
Yeah.
That guy. You ever run across Maury anymore?
Maury O'Rourke. No,
Maury
I don't.
O'Rourke,
I don't
that's
speak
it.
To him, but I talk to Don all the time.
Oh, really?
Don's really a talented producer.
Yeah. Don is a little bit
Nashville.
Older than us. He'd been around.
Yes.
done a lot.
He actually
things.
Married the girl that I was coming out of the house that when I saw you.
Oh, okay. All right.
But,
man, oh, man.
Yeah, it's a long story.
Well, let's go back a little bit and figure out, hear about your origin story. So where you're not from Baton Rouge or New Orleans.
I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana.
You did?
I did.
Huh. Oh, so
I grew up in the Garden District.
Huh, okay. Where'd you go to school here?
I went to public grammar school.
Yeah,
LaSalle.
Yeah. LaSalle Elementary School.
It was a public school that had a bunch of rich kids in it.
Okay.
It was before integration, and just pretty much everybody sent their kids to LaSalle if he could.
Okay.
And
in the Garden District. All right.
No. It was LaSalle was on near Audubon Park.
Oh, okay.
But they had all these tricks to... to get in the right the
district,
right area.
Different district, right. You could,
yes.
get a piece of mail from somebody else's house within that
something like that.
Within
I don't
that,
know.
That
I was
district.
I was very young.
Right. You weren't doing all the time.
I wasn't doing the shenanigans.
Right.
I was
right.
I was going to school, and so.
Well, so is your family from New Orleans?
No, my from North Louisiana.
Okay.
I was born in North Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
Last person born into. The Clark family house. I was born in a house, in a big house.
Oh, all right.
And then we moved to Baton Rouge when I was four. Went to nursery school in Baton Rouge and then came here in 65.
Oh, okay. And you went to high school here in New Orleans?
Basically moved into our house and the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan.
Ah.
Like that week.
All right.
That changed my life.
Now, you know, I recently saw that
64?
Beatles documentary, Beatles 64.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's terrific, man. It's cool.
Yes.
So you saw them. Now, did that make a big impact on you, seeing them on Ed Sullivan? Did that register?
Yes. Everything's just
everything changed.
Stopped. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
On our little black and white Zenith television.
Right. Right. Right.
And yeah.
What is that? Zenith. The quality goes in before the name goes on.
And
that,
my parents were cool enough where yes, the quality does go in. My parents are actually cool enough to let us watch it without saying, you know, whatever.
Okay.
Like most of the people we saw on the on that documentary were like, oh, my parents wouldn't shut up the whole time. Right. You know, like, no, right. My parents let us watch. And then...
Was that the same show where they had the plate spinners? I used to love the plate spinners.
Immediately after the Beatles. Ed Sullivan was a plate spinner.
Yeah, it was the Luigi family or something like that.
Not related to the other Luigi.
It was some Italian family or some foreign family that spun plates.
Yeah, they showed a bit of that in the documentary.
Yeah, the next act.
Yeah,
I like those kind of variety acts.
But you need to see this movie.
What movie?
It's called 1964.
Beatles. I thought it was a documentary.
Documentary film.
Okay.
Let me get up on my soapbox.
You know, I've seen enough of the Beatles. How much Beatles shit can you do?
Here's the thing.
You know, it's just like there's a show. That was actually entertaining because I realized that Yoko wasn't the problem in Get Back.
She was not the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the other wives were there just as much as Yoko was in Get Back.
Not so much.
They were all there. They just weren't singing.
As part of revenge, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. But I've seen so many fucking Beatle documentaries. I don't need to see anymore.
Well, I will say the one thing that blew my mind about that was... There's a show in D.C. when they played in the boxing rink, and I've been seeing that footage for forever, and whoever did the sound for this movie completely restored. They took one track off of a microphone, got rid of all the screaming, and brought out George's guitar.
That's AI, man. It's insane. AI did that, man.
It's insane, man.
And I'm afraid of AI. I don't like AI.
It sounds fantastic.
Does it really?
I don't like AI either.
Yeah.
This is more hands-on. This is Giles Martin doing this.
Yeah, he does a terrific job remixing
that. George Martin's cousin.
He never could hear the music on that show.
Right. All the screaming. It's insane. Yeah. So you go to high school in New Orleans?
I went to De La Salle High School on St. Charles Avenue.
All right. I think you're the second guest that went to De La Salle that we've had. So you went to Trinity before that?
I did go to Trinity before that.
Now, were you raped at De La Salle? Because I hear a lot of rape stories.
I haven't heard any of those.
I've heard tons of rape stories.
Okay. It happened, but I was not one of the raped.
When I first moved here, I worked at Langenstein's near De La Salle.
Right in the neighborhood, yeah.
And, one of my favorite places.
And a lot of the stock boys, after school kids would come, and they would talk a lot about sexual shit going on.
But
at
that's
De La
later.
Salle.
That kind of happened.
Early 2000s.
Yeah, that kind of after I left.
Yeah.
Right after I left.
Dodged a bullet, huh?
Yeah. Yes. But yes, I did go to Trinity prior to that.
That's pretty ritzy
it was.
Environment.
I don't know how my parents were able to do that.
Okay. Now, what did your parents do?
My dad was in medical sales, and my mom
was a drug dealer then, right?
No.
No?
Medical equipment.
Oh,
stuff
medical
like that.
Equipment.
Yeah.
Iron
early heart early heart stuff. Okay. Very early heart monitor stuff.
Well, your mom was a housewife.
My mom was a housewife, but then she started working in insurance investigation.
Oh, that's a cool gig.
Which is kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's
so
a cool
I was a latchkey kid.
And how many kids were there?
My sis and I. And my first band was when I went to Trinity.
Huh.
Harry and the Hot Rods.
Oh.
You were already playing drums this time?
Right after that, the Beatles thing, all I wanted for Christmas, every Christmas, was drums.
Yeah.
And they got me like a toy drum set, which I destroyed like
first
by
afternoon.
New Year's.
Uh-huh, right.
And then I begged for a drum set, and they're like, Santa cannot afford a drum set. So I started saving money. I started working for my uncle on a golf course in Baton Rouge.
Hmm.
And I just saved, and then Santa gave me a snare drum that I still have for one Christmas, and and I just started building from there.
Right. That's what they always say. You should start with the snare and learn to play that and then add pieces.
Well, I don't know if I don't know if I ever learned to play any of it, but but I received one.
Okay.
And then
and you had some other guys at Trinity that were that played guitars and
well, I don't know if you remember the early 70s, but the Episcopal Church had what they call guitar mass.
Oh, I sure remember guitar mass. Yeah,
and
yeah. That drove me out of the Catholic Church, but
guy wanted drums in there, and I'm like, "Are you sure you want drums? Like, I'm fucking loud." And he's
so
like,
y'all were playing in services.
Yeah, so I started playing with those guys. And then there was one guitar player that was just like New Orleans's answer to Chuck Berry.
Huh, okay.
And we started, it was right about the time that Happy Days and American Graffiti, or American Graffiti came out and then Happy Days. So we were all into 50s music. And we just started a 50s band for this... Some people say talent show, but it was more of a the Trinity adults putting on a cavalcade kind of show, and we were the band on their American Bandstand spot.
And y'all were a big hit.
That was the first live.
All the girls reacted. They wanted to talk to you.
Well, yes,
right.
Well, that was the first time I ever played on stage. Like you know when, and it was a packed auditorium.
Nice.
So,
and you caught the bug.
And so we started playing, and then we started getting paying gigs. And
now, where were you playing these paying gigs? Like dances or something?
The first live show that I ever played out for pay was right in my neighborhood now, which is in the Lower Garden District. Was at this house that had a huge, like, ballroom for a living room. And it was the Mercy Sweet 16 party in 1972.
Mercy Academy.
And it was, so these girls were 16 and we were like 12. And we're like making out with these 16-year-old
girls. Yeah.
All right. All right. There you go. Yeah.
Using both hands.
Playing,
right?
Both hands and lips.
Yeah.
And, and Mr. Maroney out in his station wagon smoking a pipe waiting for us to finish so we could...
you know, he was your handler.
He would load our stuff out.
Oh, okay. He was your manager.
He was someone's dad.
Right.
And then
stage dad.
Yeah. So our guitar player was
so
really good.
Did he hit on the 16-year-olds too?
Did we what?
Did he hit on the 16-year-olds?
He was outside reading the whole time.
Oh, reading with his pipe and stuff. Like
waiting
that.
For us to be done.
Ah.
So you
patiently
you played all through high school when you were at De La Salle. You played
no
actually. Okay.
So that band, we started playing some CYOs and Episcopal Youth things and for money. And my drums were crap. And the headmaster of Trinity bought a, I'm using air quotes here, bought a set of drums for the school, basically that I could use.
Oh, okay.
And
do you still have those drums?
No.
Oh, okay.
They're probably still in Trinity's attic.
Probably so.
But they were, yeah, they were better. They were a step up from mine. Finally, when I got to De La Salle, I bought this hippie kid's Ludwig, 63 Ludwig kit.
Nice.
Yeah. I was like, how much do you want for it? $340. And I scraped area.
It was a lot of money at that time.
Yeah, my parents helped me out to get it. And
you still have that kit?
I still have that kit.
Good for you.
It's in a studio right now across the river. But
where is that hippie kid now?
That hippie kid, I don't know. I do not know.
Okay. Left him in your wake.
I always wanted to kill him because he took the bottom heads off of the drums. So I always had to try and refine rims and stuff.
Oh, jeez.
But anyway...
So you played all through high school?
I played.
I keep saying that. Yeah.
Yeah. I did. I went out for soccer freshman, and we won state my freshman year. So I became like pretty involved in athletics.
Okay.
And then Branford Marcellus he was my buddy at De La Salle.
Oh, really? Okay.
And he talked me into playing with this this band that he was starting to play with, some kids from Newman, were kind of playing. It was almost like Springsteen-ish with a saxophone player.
Really?
Kind of thing. And he always wanted to do like Gino Vanelli covers and stuff. And I was just like, I don't know.
A little too proggy for you guys, yeah.
So then, but then he split to Berklee Academy of Music.
Right. Well, he's going to NOCA at the time, and then then left for
Left De La Salle.
What left for Berklee, and then played with.
So then I didn't play for years. I went to LSU. And
you weren't playing when you were at LSU? Really? Not,
when I first started at LSU, I majored in Dixie beer.
Okay.
And I did not play, and I was in a deke at LSU.
Oh, wow.
And it was right during the prime time and of all that, and so I didn't play until like New Wave hit.
Okay.
And then I was like,
what kind of bands were you listening to when you were in college?
Human League.
No Human League.
No.
That was later. I went to college when punk hit.
Okay. Right.
So Elvis Costello.
So when the Sex Pistols played in
I saw them.
You saw them there.
First of all, let's backtrack.
Okay, yeah, go back.
I saw the Beatles. I saw Big Star, and I saw the Sex Pistols.
You saw the Beatles live?
In City Park Stadium with Tad Gormley.
Wow, no kidding.
1965, almost 66.
Your parents brought you to that?
No, my.
How old are you?
I was born in 60, so.
So you were there at 5 years old? You went and saw the Beatles?
I was 6 years old, and
who brought you to that gig?
Well, one of my good friends was his dad worked for an oil company, and somehow wangled 6 tickets. And it was his son's birthday, so his son got to invite 2 friends, and his daughter got to invite 1 friend. So we get there after school, and we're way up in the top of the back of the stadium, and there's nothing but screaming girls. I'm short, so all I'm looking at the whole time is Catholic girls' plaid dress in front of me, screaming like crazy. The bands are playing. Fats Domino, Frogman Henry, and Fats Domino opened the show.
Okay,
all you could hear the bands are playing through a PA system, through the stadium PA system.
Right.
You couldn't hear any
coming through,
but they weren't screaming. Yeah, as soon as the Beatles started to come on, everyone started screaming, and the only way to see them was to get up on an adult's shoulders. And the adult that we were with only had 1 pair of shoulders.
Sure.
And so I probably got up there for like 4 minutes tops.
Okay, but you could feel the electricity in the
It was insane, but I couldn't hear it. You know, and screaming.
You're 6 years old. I mean, what do you... I don't get it.
Yeah.
It's just like it was crazy. Anything.
But I knew I was going to see a band.
Yeah, you're going to see a band.
And
the Fats was there, and who else?
Clarence Frogman Henry opened
the
show.
But the audience was totally white, though, right? It was.
As far as I could tell.
Yeah, it was all white.
You could only see the back of the
no one's gonna go
anyhow.
Yeah. But the one thing I do remember is when every time I got up on the shoulders, the New Orleans police tried to keep the football field completely clear. Mm-hmm. And they had all these horsemen on, horse police all around the edge. And every once in a while, a girl would try and take off for the stage, and these horses would run her down and grab her. So it's like a polo match with people in it. And that's about all I can tell you about it. I mean, I couldn't tell you what they played,
sure,
but
sure,
I saw
sure.
them.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yes.
Okay, so you're saying, but then you saw the Sex Pistols.
I did see the Sex Pistols in 77 at the Kingfish in Baton Rouge.
Right, because I remember I was at Ben Franklin at the time, but I was too young to go, and the guy, upperclassman, came back the next day, David Kent, you might even know that guy, and he's like, oh, man, saw the Pistols last night. It was so fantastic. It's like, oh, fuck you, man. I don't want to hear about it.
Did you know about them before?
Yeah.
I didn't know much about it. I had seen them on the news, NBC News or whatever, but I just happened to be going to this. There was a record store in the same little shopping mall as the Kingfish, where the club was, and this guy named Jimmy Rink owned it. It was called the Record Rink. Okay. You might have met him.
Familiar.
He's friends with Don Spicer.
All right.
That's how I met all those guys, the Baton Rouge punk guys. Was because of I went in Jimmy Rink's store on the right day.
At the record store, right?
And he's like, there's a band playing right across the street here tonight, and you might like them, because I was buying like Beatles records or something. And he's like, there's a line already. So there's already a line out the door.
So it was a pretty packed show.
I just went and got in the line.
It was pretty packed.
It was insane, yeah. We stood in line for a long time.
Yeah.
And
that was like their third gig to the end or something, right? Third or fourth gig before the...
Johnny Rotten's famous line, the last few gigs of the American tour was, he'd say at the end of the show, you ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
Yeah. Good night.
Good night, because they were so horrible apparently by then.
The
San Francisco show apparently was like three songs and was done.
I thought it was amazing, actually. I thought that Steve Jones and Paul Cook were insane.
Sure, yeah,
great.
Those guys were a great
Sid
band.
I couldn't even hear Sid.
Yeah,
they just totally turned off. So, yeah,
those guys were insanely tight and great. And something happened at the end of the show you might want to hear about.
Okay, well, maybe we should
take a break.
Yeah, maybe we should take a little break here. It seems like a good time, Manny.
Yeah, we'll be right back.
We're back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Rene Coleman, back with our guest, Mr. F. Clark Marty.
F. Clark Marty.
Well, Clark, as you may or may not be aware, the Troubled Men podcast is a listener-supported operation. We have a couple of links, a PayPal link and a Venmo link there in the show notes of every show, as well as in the Facebook posts that we use for the show.
Where can that be found?
Let them finish,
man. The notes, you know, the link is in the notes. You just scroll down and then you click on the link and it brings you to the Venmo or the PayPal accounts for the Troubled Men podcast. And so you can support the podcast there if you're enjoying the show. If not, please turn the show off. You don't have to listen to this. Also, we have a Patreon page with the link right there in those show notes as well. Also, we have the Troubled Men podcast t-shirt link there. And I want to give a shout out. That was last week. Had Arnie Skog bought a couple of Troubled Men podcast t-shirts. But this week, I give a shout out to a longtime listener and supporter, Kevin Todd, jumped on that PayPal link and bought us a round of drinks. Thank you so much, Kevin. Enjoying these cocktails. And also follow us on social media.
I can't taste any booze in my cocktail.
Huh. Really?
Tastes like all soda.
Huh. I don't know. You could go ask Vince about it.
Okay.
Like I thought he made you a drink with booze in it, but I don't know.
All right, go ahead.
I don't know. Anyway, yes, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps a lot. Cost you nothing. Also, you can see all my Iguanas dates there, and the link is that is there in the show notes, iguanas.com. Also, my Renee Coleman Facebook page has all of my non-Iguanas dates in it. And so that seems like enough of that. Back to our guest, Mr. F. Clark Marty. Now, Clark, you were mentioning something about what happened at the end of the Baton Rouge Sex Pistols gig.
The Sex Pistols show in Baton Rouge was, I thought it was, it really grabbed me, the whole show. And, of course, I was on the opposite side of Sid. I didn't,
could really hear Steve Jones good. Yeah,
yeah, I was, and towards the back as well. But after the show, a lot of people were hanging out, and the band came out afterwards, except for Johnny Rotten. And there was I talked to Steve and Paul for a little while.
Okay.
And there's a huge crowd around Sid Vicious, and everyone's just kind of crowding around. So my friend went up to and grabbed him by the shoulder and said, "Sid, I just wanted to tell you it was a great show." And he's just like, oh, thank you very much. And it turned out that a young woman was filleting him at the time, in the middle of the right in the middle of the dance floor.
And, in the club.
Inside the club.
Huh.
And
She must not have gotten very far with that, with Sid. I can't imagine that.
He started moving her up onto the bar, and then the bouncers saw it, and they're like, "Everybody get the fuck out of here." I never saw the end of it.
Yeah, but, can't see Sid as being very, very functional at that point.
But the guys that I met that night were so enthusiastic. We were all enthusiastic, and they're like, "We're going to San Antonio tomorrow for this show." Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like,
good luck with that.
They're like, "Do you want to go?" And I'm like, "Count me in." So I met them at the same spot the next day, and we took off for San Antonio.
So you saw the Pistols again in San Antonio?
Not quite.
Okay.
So we drove there. We were outside the club. It was the Longhorn Ballroom in outside of San Antonio. And we stood in line, and we were...
Pistols were really playing all the major markets, weren't they? Baton Rouge.
We were four people from getting in, and they started their set, and the guy that they beat up, the bouncers beat up, got thrown out, and we're like, "Hey, can one of us get in?" And they're like, "No, no one else gets in."
Oh, okay.
So we drove like 10 hours for nothing.
Right.
Drove back to Baton Rouge.
Okay.
Didn't Sid get his ass kicked there at that show?
Yes.
Yeah, he got after the show some fucking...
He hit someone over the head with the bass. Right. And then after the show, I guess we were already driving back.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so you
dejectedly.
So you see the Pistols in Baton Rouge. You have met a bunch of people. You start playing in bands in Baton Rouge. We need to move forward into where you're actually playing music here.
All right.
Because you've played in all these bands, but you have to start playing in a band before we can continue.
So I drank my way through the first couple of years of college, and then...
Okay, makes sense.
Then I was like, my parents moved to D.C. as soon as my sister graduated from high school. And they're like, "You got to come get your drums." And I'm like, so I went and got my drums, and they were just sitting around in my room at college. And so I answered an ad to join this band, The Change. It was are you familiar with the Baton Rouge New Wave scene?
Well, I mean, I know some of those people.
It was a huge scene, a lot of bands.
Yeah, why did your parents go to D.C.?
They decided to move...
To get rid of you, to get away from you?
Well, I was already at school.
Oh, okay.
So you didn't have somewhere to come back to? I don't know.
Yeah. I had just decided to move to D.C., and so I didn't have any roots in New Orleans for a long time.
Okay.
My sister went to LSU as well. And so I started playing with this band, The Change, and it was mostly covers. They did have some originals. So we kind of took off on the local scene, the local Baton Rouge scene. There was about four or five clubs that were booking everybody.
Right. The Chimes.
And so there were two other bands. Everybody else was There were two other bands, the Human Rays, and then
the Human Rays. Was that like a husband and wife duo with a drummer?
I'll tell you in a I'll let you know. And then there was another band called Scooter and the Mopeds. And so Bill Davis was playing with the Human Rays.
Oh, okay. And that's how I know that name. All right.
And then Hokey Hickle was playing with... so we all just decided to screw our bands and form our own band. And
which was?
Dash Riprock.
Dash Riprock. So you were the original drummer in Dash Riprock. Yeah, that trio starts there.
But I'm not proud of it.
Okay, well...
Worst band I was ever in. But I will have to say... that we were a lot different at that time. If you talk to anybody who came to see us, we were completely different.
Well, that was during the era of like Jason and the Nashville Scorchers were getting big. Yeah. So the cowpunk thing was coming into vogue.
Correct. But I was also, at the same time, started playing with OFB, our favorite band, with Don Spicer.
Right.
And so they got a little jealous about that. Because I was too tired.
Who moves from New Orleans to Washington D.C.?
this was getting in your craw.
Yeah,
my parents they had friends up there, and they went up there and loved it.
Okay.
They lived in Georgetown for a while.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just think that's a kind of an odd move.
Yeah.
Unless you're a spy or something.
Well, you know,
something
that has fascinated me about you, Clark, is that you know so many musicians in so many different scenes. You know,
You get around when you play.
Well, you've like lived in all these different places for a period of time.
True.
Like Baton Rouge, and then you were like, how do you get from Baton Rouge to, I don't know what the exact timeline is, but you spent a bunch of time in Boston and knew all those bands up there.
I'll make a brief survey. So Dash Riprock, I dropped out of that. And
now you guys recorded a single, and then
the single.
Someone in my notes told me to ask about the royalties from Shake That Girl single.
Yeah, well, that was the bone of contention.
Oh, okay.
One of the reasons why I quit was because, to me, the songwriting should have been split three ways, because we all came up with the songs together. And then the record came out, and it had one name on it.
Oh, okay.
And I'm
whose
like,
name?
Well, I'm done.
right. Sure.
And I'm
sure.
Like, well, I'm done. Right. So, then I kind of scrambled around for a little while in Baton Rouge, and I worked at the only job I ever got fired from. I worked at a fancy Creole restaurant in Baton Rouge that shall remain nameless.
Okay.
And one day I was leaning over to put water on, as a busboy, put water on some ladies' tables, and devil or angel spilled an entire cup of water right into this lady's lap.
Uh-huh.
And the manager just comes out and goes, "Clark, you are fired."
Okay.
and so I like, that's fine, because I was a fish out of water anyway.
That happened to me once when I worked at a restaurant.
Where was
I
that?
Back in L.A., yeah. I was bussing some tables, and there was this, it was a brunch, and they had this honey ham with some kind of cream sauce. And I said, done? The guy said, yeah, I'm done. I pulled the plate off, and I spilled the honey ham sauce on his back. On his back.
Honey?
And I didn't tell him. I just said,
back.
I put the dish. I said, I'm going on my break. See ya.
You didn't get fired.
No, yeah. I didn't get fired, but the guy got up and was like, what the hell happened here?
I got hammed.
Did they trace it back to you?
Well, kind of.
Circumstantially, but they couldn't prove anything.
They comped him his like coffee or dessert or something like that.
All right.
So he was happy with that. But I'm going on my cigarette break. See you later. Bye. But it was like,
and then
like
the dogs kind of followed.
It was like a raspberry cream sauce.
Oh,
like
geez, that's
purple.
That's never coming out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's never coming out.
Well, so you're rattling around Baton Rouge.
I got fired.
Baton Rouge.
The day I got fired. Uh-huh. So I go home to my apartment, and there's the phone rings and it's Charlie Pickett, and he's like, "Hey, we're looking for a drummer."
And where is that? Where are they?
He was out of Miami.
Oh, okay.
So I basically moved to Miami, went on the road for 3 years.
Really? So yeah. That was a traveling band? Okay.
Signed to Twin Tone, Charlie Pickett and the Eggs. Then the Eggs kind of split, and I stuck with Charlie.
Now, Twin Tone, that was...
Replacements.
Right,
Soul
right,
Asylum.
Right. Is that Peter Jasperson?
Oh,
okay. I see.
Nice dude.
Still, good guy. Yeah.
And so we did tons of... I did tons of touring with Charlie.
And you must have met a lot of musicians around the country while
touring with
them.
That's how I met pretty much everyone.
Okay.
And
that was out of Miami, you said.
And we played with you... Pretty sure we played with you guys at Maxwell's another time.
Okay.
But
I believe you.
I'm pretty sure.
All right. Now I trust your recollection more than
but
my
yeah,
own.
But yeah, I just started, meeting a bunch of people, and, everybody crashes at everybody's house.
Right,
and,
right.
It just networking.
Yeah, now during that time you become friends with, because I know you knew a lot of those guys in that North Carolina corridor, the DBs.
Peter Halsapple.
Let's Active guys.
Yes, but I actually saw Peter Halsapple open for REM in Baton Rouge at the Bayou in like 83.
Okay.
Before Dash Rip Rock.
Oh, okay.
He and I bonded and started writing each other a bunch. So that's that's how I became friends with the DB guys.
Oh, okay.
And then every Mardi Gras, they would have the Flesh Tones basically booked a huge rock show, usually at Willow Street, which is now Willow Street, but it used to be Jimmy's.
Jimmy's, yeah.
It used to be a big extravaganza booked by this guy, Jeff Beninato, who later... ended up being the bass player with
the DBs. Bass player with the DBs, yeah.
Great dude. Mm-hmm. He started putting together these package shows, and they would tour all the way down here and play here. I became friends with all those guys.
Okay.
Because of those DBs.
Now.
And Mitch Easter.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, now, at that time in North Carolina, was that the beginning of Southern Culture on the Skids? Were those guys going?
Actually, it was the very beginning. There was one weekend in Tuscaloosa where every frat house had some kind of band. This is when frats were booking great bands. The Let's Active was in one house. Charlie Pickett was in another house. Will and the Bushmen. And then Southern Culture on the Skids had their first live show at Solomon's in Tuscaloosa at the bar in Tuscaloosa.
So okay.
After everybody finished their frat gig, which ends early, we all went to Solomon's, and the band playing was Southern Culture on the Skids with their first drummer and everything.
First bass player. That was way before Mary Huff.
Way before.
Yeah. Because I remember the first
time.
They had
a girl drummer, too. And okay. So that's how I became friends with those guys. The story continues.
Right. Anyway. So the Charlie Pickett band, y'all were playing all those classic clubs like Chapel Hill, like Cat's Cradle
the Cavern and
right.
And every place that was on the Nick in Birmingham. So we did that, and then finally got sick of being in band with the Junkies. Non-Vietnam vet junkies.
Right.
And I decided to move one night to Suwanee, Tennessee. Let's backtrack a sec. We recorded, and Peter Buck produced our record in Athens.
Oh, okay.
And so instead of going back to Miami, I spent an entire summer in Athens. So I played in a backup band with Cindy Wilson from the B-52s.
Oh, cool.
And those guys from Dreams So Real.
You're like living in Peter Buck's couch or something?
No, there was actually a room for rent. The sound guy at the Uptown was leaving for the summer rented me his room and the Uptown Club.
Well, that's very cool,
It was fantastic.
B-52s.
Best summer of my life.
Oh, okay.
And
so far.
So I met this girl there. She went to Suwanee. And so I ended up leaving one night in Miami without telling my band. I just drove up to Suwanee, Tennessee, and lived in a girl's dormitory for about 2 months and never got caught.
Hence the title, America's Guest.
Yes. And then I slowly matriculated to Nashville, where I played with Heggy V.
Okay.
You know who Heggy V was?
I don't.
Do you know George Hamilton IV?
No.
The country artist?
No.
I've heard of him.
Classic country artist.
And Heavy D, the rapper.
No, Heggy V.
Oh, Heggy V.
His son is the George V, and they called him Heggy V.
Oh, okay.
And okay. He had a record. He's from Chapel Hill or area.
Uh-huh.
And Mitch Easter produced his record, and then he moved to Nashville and needed a drummer. So I ended up matriculating to Nashville, which was a tough gig, actually.
How's that?
Just the competition there. I'd be showing up to these auditions for things, and there's like Dave Cramp. It's like this open air auditions for things. I'm like, I'm never getting this gig.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So you didn't stay there for too long.
Not too long, and right about that time, I had. I met Derek Dickerson, who people know as Deke.
Right, right, right.
And so we started having this idea to make a surf band, a vocal surf band.
And that was Untamed Youth.
The Untamed Youth. And I moved to Columbia, Missouri, and this is about 87 or 88.
Okay.
And then so lived there for several years, touring all over the place, both east and west.
And this was the heyday of college radio, when all these bands could get college radio play, and when you'd go to some of them could get college radio play.
But none of them wanted to play a surf band, really.
Sure, but I mean, just the
WFMU,
the environment, was rich for all these bands touring. They had clubs that supported this.
You well know, yes.
Well, yeah, for context for our listeners, you know, to describe that in a way that doesn't exist now is what I'm saying.
Being in a band in the South was insanely great. Yes, there was a huge network and a bunch of almost a circuit of clubs,
right?
That I'm sure you experienced as well.
Yeah, and like one town after another, and people would come out.
Do it, and you could go back through and play. You know, after 6 months or whatever, you could go back through and do it all again.
And a lot of bands doing that. A lot.
And then it spread to the North. Yeah, but I think there's really something about being in a Southern band, pop band at the time, that was insanely great.
Yeah,
don't you agree?
Yeah. There was a lot of cool bands from down here. So at some point, you get up to Boston after this.
Well, then I quit Untamed Youth in Europe, and I.
What was going on in Europe to make you quit?
I was sour on the entire band, the entire band. I'm not going to get into it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Deke and I do not talk to each other.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Man, it happens. Yeah. Yeah.
He's a great guitar player. I'll give him all that, but not that great of a person. So, I decided to quit, and then I moved back to my parents' basement in D.C. for a little while.
Ah, okay.
And then I played with a country band there called the Reluctant Playboys. They were really good.
Oh, yeah, man.
But only did like 4 shows, and then the Incredible Casuals fired their drummer and hired me. So I moved to Cape Cod for the 90s, early 90s.
Now, Cape Cod, so that's a whole scene up there. And this guy...
At the time, it really was.
I was thinking about this guy today, knowing that you must know Trey Halliwell.
Of course, he used to. He was down here a lot.
Right, right. Well, Trey was...
He was a really good friend of mine. He was murdered.
Yeah, no, it's terrible story. But Trey was one of those magical guys that if you were hanging out in a bar and you start telling a story and you say his name, you could like turn around and he'd be right behind you. It's like, what the fuck are you doing here? That happened to me so many times in different cities, you know?
True. And, well, he's a big Iguanas fan.
Well, he was a big music fan.
Yeah, true.
How did he get murdered?
It's a long story.
Bad scene, wrong place, wrong time.
Actually, it wasn't. He was in the right place, but it was the wrong time.
No. It was a robbery.
It was a dope deal kind of thing. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and his.
It was terrible, man.
It was horrible.
And he was a sweet guy, man. And
they shot 11 people in this thing.
Oh, jeez.
Here? It was here?
No, it was New York.
It was in New York City.
Oh.
And but Trey, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It just killed the scene. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, Trey, he would come down here.
Yes.
A few years in a row, and he this is before absinthe was
correct.
Legal.
Yes.
And he had a whole absinthe brewing operation. He would steep the wormwood,
and he did it up there too.
But he had like a whole the cooling coils that they would brew this stuff, and yep. they would have a very organized thing. They'd have like bottle washing crew, and we would
you would imbibe.
What's that?
You would imbibe.
Well, they would first do like the brewing, and they'd recruit people to do it, and it was like a 24-hour day operation. So you'd have different shifts come in, and depending on how many hours you worked, that would translate to
bottles of
absinthe. You get paid in
sounds
product.
Like a way to make enemies.
I think he made a lot
Renee's
of friends.
Renee's not an enemy.
Yeah. Well,
no.
I know, but I mean, if he's in that business and it's illegal,
well, no,
there's shit
but,
going down, man.
Yeah, but nobody was there. There wasn't like an absinthe.
No,
so they never caught the killer.
It was actually the weed
they
that
never,
killed him. Oh yeah, they caught him. They caught him 2 months later.
It was
two Jamaican guys.
Oh,
and, yeah, it was
Jamaican.
Just a horrible,
just a robbery, man.
Yeah,
yeah. But anyway, Trey was.
Now, did you go
a huge
to his
Casuals
funeral?
Fan. Huh?
Did you go to his funeral?
Of course, I'll get to that. But Trey was a huge Casuals fan before he started promoting any shows or anything. So he was his parents lived on the Cape, and so he was coming to shows before
so
I even joined.
So that's very rich money. His parents.
His parents were very rich.
Yeah, Cape Cod. You got to have money there, man.
And so I joined the Casuals there.
Okay.
So we played all over the place, and then we had a regular gig every Sunday at the beach. This place called the Beachcomber.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Sunday afternoon, 4 to 8, and we made like. $2,000 or $2,000 to $3,000 every week. So if we were on tour, we would even come back just to play that show in the summer. And that's where I started meeting Trey. And so he eventually moved to Boston and started booking shows. And then he kind of blew up to be the number one promoter in Boston.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. But that was already after I had moved back.
Right. Well, so did you know those guys like Mark Sandman from Tree of Right?
I ended up moving to Boston, yes.
Okay.
When I quit the Casuals, I moved to Boston, and I knew Mark Sandman, but I had met him at Maxwell's when he played with the Turbines before that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Maybe on a bill with us.
Right.
But
what a guy.
But anyway, I kind of matriculated to Boston and just fell into the slew of just my drummer blew up. Can you help us out?
Yeah.
Like one of those things like
proximity is so important in the music business, man.
It was insane.
Are you here?
It just like,
yes.
My drummer's getting married next week. And so I was just like Johnny on the spot there. So I got to do my first bus tour and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And
who was that with?
I was with the Dam Builders.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Man, so many bands. It's hard to know them all.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, you pretty much name every major label band from Boston, and I did some time with them.
Yeah,
Mary Timony, Helium, Fuzzy.
What about
Aerosmith?
The Liars?
Aerosmith.
Before my time.
Oh, okay.
What about the?
I'm not that old.
What about the Liars? Mono
Man. I did 3 shows with Mono Man.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
I love that band.
Well, I was in a band with his wife. I was in a band with Priscilla, his wife at the time, called Speed Queen.
Mm.
And he's like, hey, man, Murphy ain't going to make these shows in Worcester. Can you do it? And I'm like, no practice. And he's like, yeah. All right. I guess I can wing it. So I did, and then he got me for two more shows after that.
Nice. I played some shows.
I love the Liars.
With the Panther Burns opening for the Liars.
Yes.
I remember a mono man would be playing the organ with one hand, playing the tambourine with the other, and singing, leading the whole band.
Yeah.
Fucking and, maniac.
And giving the drummer shit the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But that reminds me, Panther Burns played at, you may not, on Britannia, at that, there's right by where the bridge goes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You remember that show?
Yeah, yeah, I do.
That may be where we met.
Okay, actually. Yeah, it was, yeah.
Because I went to see Chilton there. Chilton told me he was playing there.
Okay, well, yeah, Alex and I were on a, coming off of a trio tour with him, and we drove straight. We dropped Doug off, I think, in Memphis, and then we drove straight down and played that show with the Panther Burns, yeah. Right.
And Ross Johnson was there, and that's how I met him,
yes.
and I'm still really good friends with Ross.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the Baron of Love.
That building is insane. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but have you revisited that?
I haven't been back there, but you know,
there's a huge ballroom in this building.
But Lorette Velvet, who was
Lorette was just here.
Right, and she was just here, but she mentions I was talking to her and she was talking about that gig and how they saw that Annabelle Linderink had promoted that show, Alex's girlfriend
at
the time.
Right.
And that she and Tav, Lorette and Tav she was so impressed by just the DIY kind of throw your own show and all these people showed up that they went back to Memphis and started putting
doing
on like
stuff.
A Counterfest, the Counter Festival to Memphis in May and doing all these loft shows.
She
mentioned that as an inspiration.
Interesting. Well, that was a watershed show.
I remember that night very well, actually.
The room was great. I wish that place was a club now.
It was an amazing space. Well, so going down to moving a little bit more quickly,
sure. Yeah.
A couple of names, Low Straitjackets is one, and then Nikki Sudden and Epic Soundtracks is the other.
Okay, well, I'll advance. So I spent a lot of time in Boston with a lot of bands, and then I knew Danny Amos from the Ray Beats. The Ray Beats had played at Mardi Gras a long time before that, and he called me up one day, and he's like, hey, our drummer, their drummer at the time was also in the band Webb Wilder.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he had a conflict, and the Webb Wilder must have been more money or something. And they're like, well, we have a tour. So he's like sent me a cassette before their record even came out. And I learned everything on it. And then they came up and picked me up in Boston, and we did a whole leg of a tour there. All the way back to Nashville. Then I flew back and then came back and did the second leg of that tour with them as well. Wearing the mask, everything.
Oh, with Low Straitjackets.
Brilliant fun. Love all those guys.
Now, you know, Eddie Angel.
I do.
Actually, I got a email from Tav Falco today. And It was thanking everyone who had participated in this new record that's going to come out next year.
Oh, wow.
And this is a record that it's either a Tav or a Panther Burns record. I'm not sure how it's going to be billed, but produced by his guitar player, Mario Monteroso, recorded in Memphis. And it's like a whole collection of all these people that have been in the Panther Burns over the
like
years.
Oh, like an alumnus
like
thing.
Maybe like 30 or 40 different people. And
nice.
I'm on one track along with a whole bunch of different people. It's
cool.
Called Desire on Ice. So everybody look for that. But
I will definitely check that out. Always a Panther Burns fan.
Yeah, man. Crazy to the Panther Burns. You never know when they're going to reach back and activate you.
And scratch you.
Right.
Scratch it.
So I
did the tours with Low Straitjackets. Then because of that, Link Ray had been seeing me at one show, and he's like, I got a tour in Australia coming up, so I got to go to Australia with Link Ray.
With Link? Wow.
Yeah, but it sounds fantastic.
Yes.
But his wife at the time was a Nazi from Danish woman who did not, you must never leave the van. You can never leave. Like, I would try to leave with some girl. She's like, Link would not like this. And I'm like, Link doesn't care. So it was a little bit more like being in the Osmonds or
cock something. Blocking you there.
Yeah, okay. all around the rim of Australia.
Oh, geez.
Getting the rim job. But it was great to play with Link. Unfortunately, the bass player at the time was super into metal. So it wasn't what we all would
Weird,
think,
man.
But
yeah,
it was
yeah.
still fun. it was still fun.
So does that connect you to Nicky Sudden?
And, no, Nicky Sudden thing happened when I moved back. I left Boston. I moved back to New Orleans on Alex Chilton's on recommendation.
Oh, okay.
I came down here to play. He's like, you ought to move back here, man. And so I did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so I started playing around with the Pendleton's guys and stuff like that.
Oh, right,
and,
right, right.
And
right.
I don't know. I was they had some drummer issues at the time.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah. I could see that. Louis, yeah. King Louis. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He would like to not show up sometimes.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
I would have
Makes
to be
sense.
The minute man to show up and play his drums and stuff.
Right.
Sometime. Anyway, there was a promoter here that was booked the Panther Burns and Nicky Sudden on a riverboat.
Oh, okay.
And I guess you didn't do that?
No, I wasn't on that gig.
Yeah, it was on the Creole Queen, and so I rehearsed with Nicky, and I guess we did that show, and I guess he dug what I did, so he's like, you know, brought me up to Chicago for... that's kind of where he was based out of in America.
Oh, okay.
So I did several tours with him. And then his brother actually moved to Chicago too, because they had the same management.
Epic Soundtracks.
Epic Soundtracks moved
right,
to
right.
Chicago.
Who had played with Nick Cave and
yes.
all kinds of people.
Yeah,
terrific drummer.
He was in Swell Maps. And so he... They had a drummer in Chicago that they played with, but if... either one of them was going on tour, they had conflict, so I was the other guy. So I went out with Epic a couple of times too, and that was fantastic.
Man, I love the way that guy plays.
Yes,
man.
I do. And then Nicky kind of junked out for a while and moved back to England.
Right, right.
And so I came back, and then I did a Sparkle Horse tour before.
Crazy, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus.
Before his accident.
You're like Forrest Gump.
Kind of.
Rock and roll.
I've never seen that, but I'll take your word for it. But, yeah.
So early days
I like
of
to say Zelig.
Zelig, yeah. You often use that. Yeah, it's a, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I came back here, and then I started, I just happened to get on this R.L. Burnside tour because...
How did that happen?
His grandson was playing drums, but he had a drug bust, and so they had booked a tour in Japan, and he couldn't leave the country. And so John Stewart from Wilco said, I know this drummer that could do it. And so Kenny Brown came down and picked me up.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Neckbones guys.
Connecting all the dots, well, Clark.
The Neckbones were playing here, and Kenny Brown drove them down in his van. So he's like, I was actually living in Boston at that time, and went to Japan with RL for 2 months.
Jesus Christ.
Or two different months.
That must have been wild, man.
It was great.
It was also a three-piece band?
It was
two guitars and you?
Two guitars, Kenny Brown, RL and me.
And you.
It was fantastic.
Man.
And then the next time Kenny Brown got into some dispute with RL, and Dave from the Neckbones played guitar, and that was a lot of fun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So those two tours were fantastic. And, of course, being in Japan is awesome.
Man, oh,
as
man.
As I'm sure you know.
I've never been to Japan.
Oh.
No.
You should go.
Never been to Australia either.
Yeah. So then I was also playing with about six bands here in town, too.
Well, and
one of them was Rotary.
Rotary Downs, yeah. One of my favorite bands in New Orleans.
Yep.
They've played for years.
Great guys. I still get along with them. I've been in Memphis at the same time. So I had two places for a little bit. Like... And I was playing with the Compulsive Gamblers guys,
uh-huh.
And going back and forth, and the conflicts caused me to leave Rotary Downs.
Okay.
Yeah. They needed someone more steady.
Right. Well,
and then,
well, I was going to say, well, we're kind of running out of time here. Yeah, winding this down. But you're back in New Orleans now.
Yeah, I'm back here. I moved back to New England for a long time and started playing solo shows, recording, figuring out how to be a songwriter myself.
Okay.
Instead of, and so then I moved back here to help my parents get off of this earth and kind of back.
Nice.
And I'm in the same place that I lived in before Katrina.
So your parents are back in New Orleans?
They died. They moved back to New Orleans to be with my sisters.
Die.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Elephant's graveyard. I always say people always come back to New Orleans to wrap it all up.
That's right. So that should lead you into your wrap-up.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, Clark, it's so fantastic. And again, people, I love to have people on the show because as well as I know them, I always find up so much more, man. This is fascinating, Clark.
Me about you, too.
Man. Yeah.
We need to find out more about Manny here. So.
Oh, well.
No, you don't need to.
Take it away.
No, well, we have a thing here that Troubled Nation knows the drill, so we're going to say goodnight.
So thank you so much, Clark.
Thank you.
And it's a fascinating story, and you know, we'll have to do this again sometime.
Part two.
Part two, that's right. And as always on the Troubled Men podcast, we like to say trouble never ends.
But Clark, the struggle always continues. Good night.
Good night.
back.